choice.
Previously,
the uterus is just a big muscle. I mean, you know, I tell my patients the uterus is kind of like a jelly donut. You have this big muscular wall.
I know you say that, and I always think that sounds so weird.
I know it does, but you know what? Patients can relate to jelly donuts, and they can't relate to uterus. You know, I mean, everybody's had a jelly donut.
You know, most people think, hey, this is easy. I'm going to stop taking my pills and, you know, we'll start having sex every other day mid-cycle. And, you know, lo and behold, it'll happen in a month. But in fact, that's really not always the case, which is why the whole show is here and why the, you know, infertility practice is here. But
this is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370. Online worldwide at talk1370.com.
Good afternoon, Austin. It's Dr. Kalen Silverberg from the Texas Fertility Center. We've got a very special guest today. We're joined by Dr. Chris Seeker from Austin Area Obstetrics and Gynecology, and we'll get to Chris in just a minute. I just want to do a little housekeeping here. First of all, we are live in Austin. It's about 7 minutes after 12 on Saturday, the 26th of February. I'm reading my notes here, and it says Tuesday. I can't understand that, but anyway, it's the 26th, and we got a yucky day outside. Oh, my God. I mean, I was telling Dr. Seeker, we're looking out the window, and it's supposed to be so beautiful. I touted all week. I was telling him, you know, he's going to have so much fun coming on the show, and we'll look out the window, and you have this beautiful view of the city. Not today. We have clouds, and we've got kind of drizzle, and hopefully it's going to clear up in a little while. But we've got a pretty exciting show today. I think we're going to have a good time. We're going to talk about the surgical treatment of infertility. Chris does probably more surgery than anybody in town, and he's really a great guy to have on the show to talk about this. I'd like to tell y'all, first of all, I would like to remind you about our website, www.txfertility.com. It's a terrific site. It's an authority site. We have about 150 to 160 pages of information on the site. I would strongly encourage you to go visit that site for all kinds of information about everything from the demographics of infertility, who it affects, and why it's important, to the different diagnoses that can cause infertility and different treatments. Also, if you're interested, you can please call our office, area code 512-451-0149. And also, if you have any questions or anything you'd like to talk about the topic today, the surgical treatment of infertility, or about infertility in general, please call in. We have a live call-in show today. It's the phone number is area code 512-390-1370. So again, it's 512-390-1370 if you have any questions either for Dr. Seeker or for myself. And some more updates here. I just want to remind our patients and anybody who's interested, we provide an IVF orientation the second Wednesday of every month. It's at North Austin Medical Center. It's free. It's on the second floor in the auditorium. We do ask you to RSVP. So again, if you want to RSVP, if you'd call the office at 451-0149, we need you to RSVP so we'll know how many people are coming, because we do provide dinner. And it's a great overview of infertility and also mainly in vitro fertilization. So it's mainly for our IVF patients. We also provide a maybe baby seminar at Round Rock Hospital. And again, you can call the office for specific dates and times about that. And then the last thing I'd want to update everybody on is we've now opened a full-service andrology laboratory at our office in Round Rock. So that's directly across the street from the Women's Center out at Round Rock Medical Center, right off of 620. And we have full-service andrology there, which means we're doing semen analyses and angiosperm antibodies and preparations for intrauterine insemination as well. So without further ado, I want to get to our guest, because I'm so excited he's joined us today. Our guest is Dr. Chris Seeker. And Chris, how about why don't you introduce yourself and tell everybody a little about you and where you went to school?
Well, Kaylin, I just want to say how humbled I am to be sitting across from you and to be welcome to be here with you. I did the 12 years of training it takes to be an OB-GYN, and then wore out long before you did to do the extra several years you have to do to become a fertility specialist, and it's just such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. Where'd you grow up?
West Texas, Odessa. My family kind of followed the oil field around Odessa. Ended up in Lubbock for Texas Tech undergrad, where a beautiful city from wherever I've been.
That's great.
And then I got down to San Antonio for med school and saw Austin a few times and realized I needed to end up here. Did 4 years of residency and internship up at Baylor Dallas.
Before. That's where you and I met.
Right.
Yeah, we actually met at Baylor Dallas, which was such a great program. It was so much fun there.
We were interviewing at the same time for the same place up there. I remember.
A great place.
So glad you decided to go someplace harder to get into so
Spot. That's a nice try. That's not true. But it was a terrific place. And then when did you move to Austin?
22 years ago.
That's great.
So I've been in practice with the same group since the day I got here.
So tell everybody, who's in your group now?
Let's see. It was founded by Harold Brumley, and Mark Aiken was there when I came along. He'd been there a few years before me. And then we got Mike Phillips, Marco Uribe, Rob Cowan. We were lucky enough to pick up Patrick Pivato, who's been in Austin, real favorite.
Right.
OB-GYN of the city this last year.
Yeah, Pat's a great guy, and I know he's happy. He's so happy to be with you guys now, so I think that's great for him too.
Yes, and then we've got two new physicians from Dallas that'll be joining us this summer.
That's great. That's great. Well, anyway, let's talk a little bit about, we wanted to talk really about surgical treatment of infertility today. And I think for the first segment, kind of I thought it'd be a good idea just to give everybody an overview of surgery and surgical management of fertility. Because, you know, people are so concerned about surgery. Everybody hears the term surgery and they think, oh my gosh, you know, is it brain surgery? Is it heart surgery? You know, everybody's got all the misconceptions and preconceived notions about everything from anesthesia to incisions to it's going to hurt and how long am I going to be in the hospital? Maybe I'm going to be there for several days. So what I thought we would do for the first segment is just kind of give an overview of the different types of surgery that we use in gynecology and in infertility. And so I kind of broke it down as to laparoscopic surgery, hysteroscopic surgery, and we'll explain each of these terms in just a minute. Bigger operations are what we call laparotomies. And then what I want to end up with before we finish today is a discussion about robotics, because I know this is something that you're getting into and it's really getting a lot of press. It's really a sexy topic and people want to talk about it a lot. So I figured that we would end up on that topic and whet everybody's appetite for that. So how about just talk about anesthesia first. How about, you know, how do you decide what kind of anesthesia to use for procedures?
You know, we have a few choices from the most minimal anesthetic, which is just a local, what we call sometimes a paracervical, a block that we can do to perform very minor procedures, usually in the office setting, just to get a little bit of numbness like the dentist might use so that we can get a procedure done in the office. And that's the least invasive, but also the often the least comfortable type of anesthetic.
Yeah, but so what does it do? It numbs up the cervix, it numbs up the uterus so that you can do basic vaginal procedures that way?
Typically lets us get the cervix dilated enough so that we can insert a scope and take a look internally, the hysteroscopy procedures.
Yeah, but it's so cool, though, to be able to do this in the office because it's less expensive.
Right.
Right? I mean, you don't have to pay the surgery center or the, you know, the hospital.
Right, and real easy for the patient. And now we've gone one step further by having the in-office anesthesia and the IV sedation procedures that now we can do in the office, and we can do that very comfortably, safely, and inexpensively.
So how does IV sedation work? What happens?
IV sedation, the medications from an IV is given, and the patient doesn't lose their ability to breathe for themselves, and of course they need to be monitored, and the level of sedation by the anesthetic is adjusted by how much intravenous medication they're given.
Sure. So it's kind of, you turn it on and it mm-hmm. works really quickly, doesn't it? I mean,
right.
it's incredible how fast patients kind of doze off. And
they usually just comment, they can't believe we're done.
Right.
They say they haven't slept well in months, even
right.
though they didn't go to sleep. And then they wake up real cheerfully ready to go in about 15 minutes. And the last thing they usually say is, did I say anything funny or tell any of my secrets?
Isn't that so funny? I mean, patients say the same thing all the time. It's hysterical. Everybody says, okay, now, you know, I want to make sure I don't give away any, like, you know, major secrets. And, you know, in the old days, I used to joke with patients and say, oh my God, I can't believe, hey, how did you know all your bank account numbers? And how did you, you know, but it's so funny because nobody ever says anything. It's just, it's so funny. But I tell my patients, look, you know, it's like you're going to go to a beach in the Caribbean for about 15, 20 minutes and you'll wake up with no hangover. Yeah. It's such a cool thing.
Yes. I just had a patient yesterday in an in-office procedure, and it was your partner, Dr. Vaughn's beautiful daughter, who was doing the anesthetic. And the first patient just came to the office and said she'd do that procedure, but she didn't want an anesthetic. She'd had colonoscopies and other procedures without one.
Oh, boy.
Natural childbirth 3 times.
That's a brave woman.
And she said, I'm going to do this without an anesthetic. And I begged her. I said, I wouldn't let my daughter do it. And she had an anesthetic. And then her last comment to Dr. Marquardt, the anesthesiologist, was she wanted to go back and do all the things she had done without an anesthetic over again.
That's so true.
With her there.
Right, especially natural childbirth. Oh, my God, having had a colonoscopy, I can't imagine doing a colonoscopy without anesthesia.
Right.
That's like the last thing I'd want to think about.
Right.
So as far as types of incisions, let's stay with anesthesia for a minute, because beyond paracervical blocks and beyond IV sedation, we have something called general anesthesia, right, where
yes.
patients get put to sleep. So how does that, you want to talk a little bit about how that works?
Yes, general anesthetic, the level of sedation is deeper to the point where the respiratory needs to be supported and with an airway, and that's necessary for our abdominal procedures like laparoscopy or anything where we're making an incision. So that's a general anesthetic, and that can be done with the same agents that we do with IV sedation, but sometimes with inhalational agents or gases as well.
Sure. So this is bigger procedures. And I remember the data from when laparoscopy first started, I think people tried to use IV sedation, and it was just agony for the patients, because when you fill up the abdomen with gas, they would get this sensation that they just can't breathe.
Right.
And so, it was really horrible. And so even though patients are afraid, I think, of general anesthesia, it's really the safest type of anesthetic.
Right. I always enjoy when the anesthesiologists say, we have statistics to prove you're safer under the general anesthesia
right.
than you were driving to the hospital to get one.
Exactly right. And that's the truth. I mean, the data show very clearly that, you are much more likely to have an accident on the way to the operating room for surgery. I don't mean an accident in the hospital. I mean an accident driving your car.
Right.
Than you are to have anything go wrong in surgery.
Right.
And fortunately, your practice and my practice, we operate basically on relatively young, relatively healthy people.
Yes.
So, this is not, where you've got neurosurgeons or you've got trauma surgeons who are operating on people who've had gunshots or, stab wounds or horrible fire injuries or related injuries. And, those people are the ones, if God forbid anybody's going to have a problem in surgery, it's going to be those people.
Right.
So how do you decide whether to operate on somebody in your office or the surgery center or a hospital? How do you make that call?
The limit of what we can do in the office is the IV sedation type anesthetic. So it's usually the vaginal and uterine procedures, but typically nothing that we'll do with an incision or a laparoscopy.
Sure. So then just, if you're going to look inside the uterus to make sure there's not a polyp or a little scar tissue
right.
or something like that, you can do that in the office. That's great.
Right.
And then as far as length of hospital stay, if you're doing it in the office, how long do they stay typically after an office procedure?
15, 20 minutes. Most people are smiling and they've filled out their evaluation forms and they're loaded up. They're often tempted to drive home themselves.
But, right.
We say they're legally DUI, driving under the influence for
sure.
that day. So someone drives them home. I usually tell them it all depends on if you're hungrier or sleepier.
Right.
Because we make them come in hungry. If they're still hungry, we let them go to dinner. And if they're sleepy, we tell them to go take a nap.
Go home and go to sleep.
Most of them say they stopped for lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And, then as far as doing things in a surgery center or a hospital, I think that a lot of that is really dictated by the insurance companies or by managed care. As far as, questions we always get are, how long am I going to be in the surgery center? How long would I be in the hospital? And, we tell our patients, I'm sure the same thing that you do, that it really depends on the type of procedure.
Right. Most of our surgeries have moved to the outpatient surgery centers. And most of them are going home even for our most major procedures, hysterectomies and
right.
pelvic floor reconstructions. Most of those are going home with no more than Band-Aid incisions and the same day of surgery. They can stay overnight at the surgery center
yeah.
as well. So it's rare that we have someone in the hospital for these types of procedures anymore.
It's so remarkable because when you and I were in residency, oh my gosh, I remember, hysterectomies, that was a 4-day stay. I mean, you'd make
right.
this big incision in the abdomen and patients would be in the hospital for 4 days. And the first day after surgery, maybe we'd let them have, sips of water
right.
or,
yes.
Or something. And then the second day, we'd try and get them out of bed and
right.
move them around and maybe they could eat.
Yeah, it was only 20 years ago.
I know, it's incredible.
And now they come in and leave the same day with a better procedure that they recover from so much faster.
Yeah, much more quickly.
It's been a great time to be in this field.
Yeah, it's really been terrific. Well, I'll tell you, we're coming up against a break, so I know that we're getting the high sign from Snoop here, so we're going to go take a break, but I'm encouraging everybody to come back and join us for segment number two. We're going to talk a little bit more about laparoscopy in detail. Again, this is Beyond the Birds and Bees. Dr. Kalen Silverberg, Dr. Chris Seeker. And if you have any questions, please feel free to call in at 390-1370, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekend.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Beyond the Birds and Bees. Dr. Kalen Silverberg from Texas Fertility, and I'm joined today by Dr. Chris Seeker from Austin Area Obstetrics and Gynecology. We're live in Austin on Saturday the 26th. It's still crummy outside. Snoop, I thought you were going to fix the weather here and make it be sunny for us.
Well, you know, I can't work magic, but I'll see. I'll do a little rain dance.
Yeah, don't do the opposite of a rain dance. That's what we don't need, is a rain dance.
Oh, yeah, duh. Okay.
I'll do the sun dance.
I'll do the sun dance. I think I just do it in reverse.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. Well, so we talked a little bit with Chris about surgical management. We talked a little bit about anesthesia. And what I really want to focus on for this segment is laparoscopy, which goes by a lot of different names. Some people call it minimally invasive surgery, or some people call it belly button surgery. There's all kinds of names that it goes by. Chris, why don't you give us an overview, really, of what laparoscopy is?
Laparoscopy is basically putting a scope we call the laparoscope, usually right at the belly button incision, and through that scope, with the patient under an anesthetic and with the abdomen that's inflated with some gas so that we can make space and see, we can see everything from the lower pelvis to the upper abdomen and perform almost all procedures that used to require an incision through little Band-Aid incisions.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We were talking about this during the break that, oh my gosh, when we were in residency, you know, you'd come in for a bigger abdominal operation, either a hysterectomy or to get fibroids out, and, you know, you'd make these incisions that went from one hip to the other hip,
right.
And we'd put in these big retractors and use these big clamps, and, you know, patients would have slow recoveries, and the operation took hours, and you had a lot of bleeding, and, I mean, it was just really an ordeal, and now, you know, we can do these same procedures in an hour, hour and a half,
right.
Less sometimes. I mean, you're a wizard. You can do these things in 25, 30 minutes. But, I mean, it's incredible.
Wonderful for patients. We can show them pictures or videos of their procedure right afterwards, and they can understand exactly what was done and what to expect afterwards.
Well, you're probably more patient than I am with videos. My attitude about video, you know, we used to videotape everything,
right.
In the old days, and patients would bring their videotapes in and they want you to sit there and watch it.
It's, right.
I mean, to me, it was kind of like going to a movie the second time,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I've already seen that one. I know how it
is. I agree. The nice pictures have made you not have to watch those with the second and third time.
Yeah. So, I love the pictures because the pictures, I think, convey the same thing. They really,
right.
You know, show patients really what happened, and this is what it looked like before, and this is what we did, and this is what it looks like when we're all finished. And, you know, most of the time patients can really see the difference, and they say, oh my gosh, that looks so different. It looks, hopefully they're saying it looks so much better.
Right. Have you noticed that patients can see it and understand it? Of course, our patients are women, and we know they're so much smarter, but have you noticed their husbands just can't make heads or tails out of what you're pointing out and what you're showing them, and they certainly can't explain it to their wives later.
No, it sure does. It happens a lot. It happens a lot. But I think we put these guys under a lot of pressure because we come out of the operating room and, you know, we want to get to them immediately to say, hey, you know, your wife did fine and she had no bleeding and no problems and she's resting and recovery now, and they'll get you back in about 20 minutes to go hang out with her until she's ready to go home. And, you know, then they always say, well, what happened? What'd you do? And, you know, I'll kind of walk them through it and show them the pictures. And for those who, you know, still can stand upright after looking at the pictures, because I think that's kind of funny, too. It seems like the women really don't have a problem looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
And even the ones who say, oh, I don't even want to see it. I don't want to know what it looks like. I'm worried it's going to, you know, it's going to bother me. It never does.
Right.
I mean, they really do well. But then it's a lot of pressure to put these guys under, have them remember what we did.
And they just don't see it the first time.
No,
right.
But it's a foreign language. It really is. So we're doing lots of stuff laparoscopically. I know you're doing as much, if not more, than we're doing laparoscopically. But I think, if you had to think about the most common fertility-related procedure, not hysterectomy, because I know you do a ton of hysterectomies too, but what's the most common thing? Is it endometriosis or is there something else?
Right. And often it's a diagnostic procedure to investigate fertility or to investigate pain. And pain and fertility issues combined often is endometriosis. So that's our most common finding.
Yeah. So just kind of walk me through, or walk our listeners through the procedure. You decide that you've got a patient who needs a laparoscopy. You talk to her about the procedure. She gets it scheduled. It's all worked out. All the details are worked out with her insurance company and everything else. She shows up to the surgery center or to the hospital. And they take her in the operating room. They put her to sleep. And what happens then?
Right. Yeah. They're at the outpatient surgery center. We have them come in hungry. They meet the anesthesiologist, get an IV, and get a little medicine in the IV. We say, pick out a nice place to visit, Sweet Dreams. And the next thing they know, they're awake, and their husband and I are trying to make sense of these before and after pictures.
Right.
But during the time that they're in the operating room, a quick prep of the abdomen, a tiny incision. Oh, it's about a quarter of an inch at the belly button. And by the way, these just are scarless procedures because the incisions are so small and there's no stitches or anything that's left on the outside. So the scope goes in. We do what we call first the 50,000-mile checkup, where we put that scope and look down at the pelvis and get an idea of what our problems are and what we're going to do to fix them. And then we go all the way around the abdomen from the appendix to the liver, gallbladder, and back around to the pelvis again. Usually the first thing we're doing at that point is checking the fallopian tubes if fertility is involved.
Yeah, to make sure the tubes are open and make sure they're not...
Right, a little cannula through the cervix. We get a little dye to flow through the tubes and prove that they're open and flush the tubes. And there's some evidence that flushing of the tubes alone can improve subsequent fertility.
Yeah, we do the exact same thing. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, so as far as endometriosis, there are lots of different ways we can attack it, right? I mean, lots of toys that we have in the operating room that we can play with to try and get rid of it.
Right.
What's your preference? What do you like to use?
Usually the laser. The laser gets us with just our... you know, the energy comes right from the same scope that we have the belly button in, so we don't have to have a lot of other insertion sites or other Band-Aid incisions. And we can magnify the lesion, and we can either, which is endometriosis, and we can either just vaporize it with the laser, or we can excise it if it's a more extensive. Laser's also real good, as you know, for scar tissue or adhesion separation, which... endometriosis has that proclivity for causing scar tissue that can decrease fertility rates.
Yeah, for sure. I love the laser. I think it's terrific. And it's interesting because the laser that we use, I think you use the same one, is the CO2 laser.
Right.
And, you know, it's got a really long wavelength, so the laser is actually invisible. But when you look at it, you see a red dot, and it looks just like a pointer. You know, when you're going to give a talk, it looks like the same pointer. And so that's a second laser that we use, which is actually called a Heaney beam. And lasers, you know, without getting too technical, but lasers are named for the crystal that forms that generates the energy that generates the light. And so Heaney stands for helium and neon. So it's actually got a little helium in it and a little neon, and that generates the light that generates that red dot that you see. And so that's kind of the pointer. So when you line that pointer up on a structure, you know, when you step on that foot pedal, your light energy is going to go right there.
Right.
And it's just so terrific because it's so precise, and unlike electrosurgery where you can get spread of the current, with the laser, what you see is what you get. I mean, it just burns right there, right along those cells, and it's easy to separate tissues or to make incisions.
Yeah, very safe and very effective for removing scar tissue and endometriosis, and it sure seems like it's less likely to produce scar tissue. Or to let scar tissue return after it's removed.
I agree, and that's really what the data show. I mean, it's so wonderful because these advances in surgical therapy that allow us to do things through these little bitty incisions have really done wonders for patients because they can get the same quality of procedure. They can recover much faster. The operations typically, you know, in the old days, they were longer, but now they're much, much, much shorter and much less of a big deal. And we can do several procedures in the same morning and, you know, take care of a lot of people, and it works out really well.
Right.
And then recovery is just so easy and so simple and so straightforward. So what about fibroids? I mean, you know, because fibroids are a major problem. I mean, we've talked on the show before that fibroids are the most common tumor, benign tumor of the pelvis. By age 35, they affect about 25% of Caucasian women, about 40% of Hispanic women, about 50% of African-American women. And fibroids are just a major problem. They cause infertility, they cause bleeding, they cause pain.
Right.
So how would you approach a patient with fibroids? What's the best thing to do?
Well, our first thing we tell them is these will always be benign. And if they're not causing problems, there's something we can just monitor and watch. Pain, bleeding, fertility problems. And also just by occupying size, they can cause quite a bit of bladder symptoms or even constipation and rectal symptoms.
Sure.
So if they're not causing problems and they're not fertility desires, those are something that we can watch year to year and just monitor with the ultrasound. But eventually fibroids are likely to cause some of the problems we just mentioned. And most commonly, especially if it's a fertility issue, it's time to consider removing them.
So what's the best way? How do you decide, if a patient's got, if she has fibroid tumors, how do you decide the best way to approach it?
A lot of that depends on the location of the fibroid. If that fibroid is protruding to the inside of the uterine cavity, well, that's actually a good thing sometimes, because that's a fibroid we can remove transcervically or through the opening of the uterus, the cervix, and not have to use any abdominal incisions at all.
Yeah.
We also are fond of the ones that are protruding outside of the uterus. Those subserous fibroids, we call them, are also easy to remove laparoscopically, and those don't require a deep incision into the uterus, which is a simple thing to do laparoscopically.
Sure. And then what about if a patient has multiple fibroids, or if they're really in the wall of the uterus, or sometimes they go all the way through?
Right.
So how would you approach those? What's the best thing to do?
So those fibroids that need to be removed that are large and within the wall of the uterus, sometimes that takes us beyond what we can do laparoscopically, and that requires an open incision, what we call a mini lap or a mini laparotomy incision, to remove those. And we'll talk a little bit maybe about robotic surgery. Robotics has brought back some of these procedures to laparoscopy, even though it's multiple fibroids or larger ones through the wall. The problem really isn't removing the fibroids, because that's a simple thing to do laparoscopically.
Sure.
But getting that perfect repair on the uterus that allows that uterus to do well in pregnancy, the repair of the uterus, is why we often either need a robotic procedure or an open procedure.
Yeah, so when you say repair of the uterus that allows it to function well in pregnancy, I mean, you deliver probably more babies than anybody in town, or certainly, in the top two or three. And what do you mean by that? I mean, what can happen to the uterus when you go in and you operate on the uterus? What's the concern?
Oh, there's really about three concerns. That those first fibroids, we talked about those inside the uterine cavity fibroids, easy to remove, but a little bit of concern for scar tissue that follows the removal internally, which can cause a fertility problem. And fibroids that are within the wall of the uterus, if that's repaired snugly and in layers, we like a three-layered closure for those, then that uterus can expand to its enormous size and not have problems through the pregnancy. And then the final thing, of course, is labor. When that uterus is asked to contract, sometimes 8 or 10 hours, and the concern would be that uterus could rupture open. So sometimes we talk about delivering people who've had these types of procedures by C-section and not risking labor.
Sure. And we know that those incisions that we make in the uterus, even though we get the tissue back together and they heal really well, and it's amazing when you go back in to do, if you do a subsequent laparoscopy and you look and see these uterine incisions, sometimes you can't even find them.
Well, you can't find them when you've done them, because I've done a couple of hundred C-sections after your myomectomies, and it's always humbling to see how good they look.
No, I appreciate that, but the uterus is just, it's remarkable how the uterus heals. I mean, it really heals well, but even still, we know that even when it looks beautiful, it's only, that incision is only about 65 to 70% as strong as it was before there was an incision in the uterus.
Right.
And so I think your point is so critical about, when a woman goes into labor and that uterus is really going to contract for hour after hour after hour, I mean, just those muscles contracting, we don't want that weakness to be a problem.
Right.
Yeah, it's really a potentially significant issue. So now what about, we can also take fibroids out through the vagina, correct? I mean, you talked about that a little bit, that we can go in and do that. And how do you guys do that? I mean, what's your preference as far as taking fibroids out hysteroscopically?
Hysteroscopically, you know that involves a smaller scope that goes right through the cervix, and the uterus requires what we call an insufflation medium or something to distend the uterus so we can see. And the wire loop electrode, we call it, is still the most common way we remove those fibroids. A little small wire, about 5 millimeters, is charged with an electric current that lets us take a scoop of a fibroid, little scoop at a time, that removes the fibroid, just a shave at a time. Have you used any of the new hysteroscopic morcellators that kind of gobble up those scoops at the
same
time?
Yeah, you know, I've seen them, and I've used it a couple of times. I mean, yes. You know, they had the Vapotrode a while ago,
right.
And that just generated to me, it just generated a lot of bubbles. And
I thought so, too.
Yeah, I just didn't see a lot of value. But this new one, maybe, I think that there appears to be a little bit more value there.
Yeah, the videos look good.
Yeah.
They always can show you one case that looks real good on those. And
right. Well, those are not my cases, yeah. I can tell you, because I've tried it a couple of times, and I've tried it on polyps, and it's amazing because the cool thing is that it captures the tissue.
Yes.
Whereas the Vapotrode would just, you know, make those cells explode, and you had no specimen. You couldn't tell if it was malignant or if it wasn't. And fortunately, these are so rarely cancer anyway, it typically doesn't matter. But, you know, with those older instruments, really, you would lose all the tissue. You couldn't get any out.
Right.
And now with these new instruments, they actually capture the tissue and they pull it down into the instrument and into a little trap.
Right.
So that you can send a specimen off and the pathologist can evaluate it.
Yes.
But it's pretty cool. But I'm the same way that you are. I mean, you know, we like to use a resectoscope if we need to and use that electric current. You know, obviously, we're just taking great care to make sure that we don't damage the lining of the uterus any more than absolutely necessary.
Yes.
And sometimes, do you guys ever put balloons in the uterus after you do hysteroscopic surgery?
Yes. Yes, if we're really concerned about the possibility for scar tissue following that balloon that holds the uterine cavity open, and we tend to prescribe some estrogen, we always talk to our patients about that lining being a little bit like Bermuda grass. And
right.
if we can get that grass growing lushly, before scar tissue develops, then we're better off. And that estrogen is the fertilizer for that Bermuda grass. And if we can get that lining to grow around that balloon for a couple of weeks, then we're home free on scar tissue.
That's such a perfect analogy because it's so true. And it's true of scar tissue in the abdomen. It's true of scar tissue inside the uterus. I mean, we really want to prevent scar tissue from forming. And
right.
So by putting that balloon in and putting patients on high-dose estrogen for a couple of weeks, you know, first of all, the estrogen makes them feel pretty good.
Right.
I mean, women like estrogen, as we know. They don't like when you take their estrogen away, but they like estrogen. And so it typically makes them feel good. We put them on antibiotics for the couple of weeks the balloon is in there. And then we take the balloon out in the office. I was talking to one of your partners, Mike Phillips, yesterday about all this.
Yes.
And because we had done a procedure where we put a balloon and a lady had a big, big uterine septum.
Yes.
Which is obviously another thing. I don't know if you want to talk about that briefly or not our break.
Balloons have improved a bit, too, instead of just the modified catheter, Foley catheter balloons now. Are you using the little triangle shaped balloons?
Thomas uses that.
Yes.
Dr. Vaughn uses that a lot, and he really likes it. He likes that catheter a lot. I'm still kind of old fashioned, and I go with that pediatric Foley catheter,
yes.
And you know, I use a 12 French PD Foley and inflate it with, probably about 8 or 9 cc's of indigo carmen.
Yeah, well, you can get more volume with that than you can the new triangle balloon. That might be a real advantage.
Yeah, but he loves those. I mean, he really likes them because of the shape, I think. And
yes.
I probably just need to, you know, to get off of my my resistance and try that and see how it works.
Well, what you've been doing has been working well.
Well, have you tried that? Have you tried the triangular shaped catheter, the Cook catheter?
Yes. The way this usually goes is as you should know, when we're in the operating room and doing one of these, we all have the same operating room assistants. You know, they help you.
Right.
Tuesday, Wednesday, I might get them Thursday.
Right.
So these are really valuable people.
And, oh, gosh, you're
incredible. And anytime you're in that position, it's easy to say, what's Vaughn doing and what's Silverberg doing? And they'll give you the latest update on what the super specialists are doing and what's working well. So that's how things trickle down to
they're so
the
terrific.
Generalists.
Oh my gosh, they're so terrific. And you know, we've got some great, great assistants who we use throughout the city. Well, I think we're going to take another break here. I think I'm getting the sign from Snoop. So we're going to take another break. I'm hoping that you'll join us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk a little bit more about surgeries that we do through bigger incisions. And then we're going to pick Dr. Seeker's brain a little bit about robotics because he's got a lot of experience with the use of the robot for gynecologic surgery. So again, Dr. Kaelin Silverberg, Texas Fertility, Dr. Chris Seeker, Austin Area OB-GYN. Talk Radio 1370. If you have any questions, please feel free to call us at 390-1370, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Talk 1370.
Raindrops keep falling on my head.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds
just
and Bees
like
on Austin's Talk 1370.
All right, Snoop, that's not good. I mean, raindrops keep falling on my head. Hopefully that's going to stop in just a few minutes. Hopefully by the time Chris and I get out of here, we'll be looking at some sunshine. Anyway, welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees. Dr. Kaylin Silverberg with Texas Fertility. Dr. Chris Seeker from Austin Area OB-GYN. We are live on Saturday the 26th in a kind of gloomy day in Austin. We've been talking about surgical treatment of infertility. Chris, I think what people are really going to want to hear is more of a conversation about robotics, but I just want to briefly touch about hysteroscopic surgery for just a second. I think we've really talked about taking fibroids out. We've talked about most of the basic stuff with that. Hysteroscopy, though, we don't make incisions, correct?
Right. That's all just transcervically.
Okay. It's all just, you know, all through the cervix, all through the vagina, and we can do lots of things there, and we can do it that way. So what about bigger incision surgery when we do these laparotomies, or as you call them, mini laparotomies?
Right. And we call them mini laparotomies because the surgery center will let us do them there if we call them a mini lap.
Right.
But it's not much different, if anything at all, from what we would, you know, do in the hospital with an open incision. The surgery center just does a great job of getting people ready to go home.
So what do you tell patients when they come in and they say, you know what, Dr. Seeker, I appreciate you telling me that I need a bigger operation, but, you know, I was kind of hoping I could get it done laparoscopically. I know you're saying the better thing to do is to open me up. And I got on the internet and I looked and I see that I'm going to be in the hospital for 4 or 5 days and it's going to be, you know, 6 weeks before I can go back to work.
Right.
I mean, how do you convince them that that's just not true anymore?
Yeah, it's just not true anymore. The smaller incision and the techniques that we use can get them home from the surgery center someday or same day or overnight. And all these people come back for a 2-week check, and we really tell them there's nothing they can't do.
Great, great. Do you let them go back to work in a week?
Generally, they're ready in a week if it's an easy job like you and I have. That's not a lot of lifting and
heavy lifting,
right?
Absolutely right. And what about, you know, as far as when can they eat again and when can they, you know, our patients all, it's like the first question they want to know is when can I work out?
Right. Yes. Yeah. And thank goodness the anesthetics have gotten so much better. We usually say you can eat again when you're really confident that you won't have nausea. And so most people, that's that afternoon, even with an open incision.
Sure.
Yeah. And working out, we tell them to avoid things that are high impact and things that really isolate those abdominal muscles until they come back for that 2-week check.
Yeah, that's just great. And so what kind of procedures are you really doing at bigger? What kind of procedures would necessitate a bigger incision, I guess, is the question.
In the past, we've had the really large uteruses that we had to remove, hysterectomy, and that was an open incision. But we made it. Commitment a few years ago to not do an open incision for any hysterectomy, and we're about 99% accomplishing on that. And then, of course, the other one is those fibroids that required for the purposes of a good uterine closure for pregnancy in the future to have an open incision. And now that we've got our robotics, we're avoiding the incisions for that as well.
Well, that's a great segue. So tell us, you know, robotics, you hear the term and you see articles maybe in the Wall Street Journal, or I know that NBC News had a thing on robotic surgery a couple of weeks ago. What's the buzz about robotics? Why is it so interesting?
You know, robotics involves laparoscopy the same way we were doing it before. But instead of using our hands to hold the camera so we can see, and our other second and third and sometimes fourth hand to use the instruments that we're using to remove fibroids and to do the work that's a bit more delicate. With the Da Vinci robot procedure, we hook all these laparoscopic instruments up to the robot, and then we step away to a console, which is just the best video game you could ever imagine. And with just the movement of our fingers and wrists, we can do things very delicately, and the image is better. It's 3D HD and magnified by about 10 times. Best thing about it is we can do suturing. I know you're a master of suturing laparoscopically, and everybody else tries to emulate you, but it's hard. You'd even agree it's hard.
It's very hard.
Yes.
It's very hard. I don't agree with the first part of what you're saying, but the second part I agree with. It's very hard, and it takes a lot of practice and a lot of time to really get it down.
Right. And with the robot, all you do is, gosh, if you've that same knot you tied 24 years ago in med school,
right?
You tie the same way you do with the robot. So you can do a very secure closure, and you can do suturing that you would have to do open previously with those same Band-Aid incisions.
Well, when people hear the term robotics or they hear the term robot, I mean, I've had patients honestly ask me, well, does that mean that like this robot is going to do this operation? And what if it's pre-programmed to do an operation and I don't have those problems?
Yeah, that's a good misconception to clear up.
Sure.
Because really all the robot is doing is just precisely what your fingers are guiding it to do. And so it's not a something that you can turn your back on and tell it to do a good job.
Right.
You're still doing all the work, of course, and
right.
And it's just a bit more precise. And there were times when and a robot is just coming along nicely. Our motto with robot for the first few years is we can do things almost as well in twice as much time and also for about four times as much expense. But it's getting so much better that, you know, we're getting faster and the techniques are improving. So lots of improvements are still coming.
Yeah, but if you remember, laparoscopy was the same way once upon a time, right?
Right.
You know, yes. I mean, I remember in training when our, the head of our OB-GYN department would say, why do you guys want to do all this stuff laparoscopically?
Right.
You can do it in 30 minutes through a bigger incision and you'll be finished. And here I'm watching you guys struggle for 2 hours,
yes,
you know, to take out a fallopian tube or to take out a cyst in the ovary or, but, yes, you know, but now look what happened. I mean, you know, here we are 20 years later and these procedures cause far less scar tissue.
Right.
Patients can, you know, go back to work in a couple of days. I mean, they've got, you know, minimal incisions like you talked about before.
Right. Yeah, we're really to the point in almost every specialty in medicine. If someone tells you you're needing to have an open incision and stay in the hospital for a few days, it's probably worth at least talking to some other surgeon.
Sure, get a second opinion.
Most things are done with Band-Aid incisions in all specialties now.
Absolutely. It's amazing. I remember, you know, in the old days, we were teaching the general surgeons how to do appendectomies laparoscopically.
Fine. Yes.
And they were, you know, just really suspect of like, oh, no, we're not going to do this. And you guys make, you know, you can take out tubes, but that's easy. We're taking out the appendix, and that's critically important. And, you know, now you look at these guys in Austin and all these surgeons in Austin, general surgeons who are doing such wonderful work. I mean, they're taking out, you know, they're doing appendectomies, they're taking out gallbladders, they're doing all kinds of bigger things. I mean, you know, here we showed them how to do it, and now it's like they're racing past us and getting better, which just isn't fair.
They were really respecting us for a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that lasted for a couple of weeks until they mastered it.
Now they've forgotten that it was all us first, haven't they?
Well, you've had so much experience with the robot. I mean, I've kind of played with it a little bit, but to me, it's almost like kind of like Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Right.
I mean, you know, you sit there and you can do all these unbelievable things and you move your hand in this direction or that direction. And the robotic arm is just simulating and doing exactly what you're telling it to
do. Right. The other use I think we'll have for the robot in the years ahead is this occasional tubal reversal procedure. And, you know, you always have to do the math and specifically about, are you better off with in vitro fertilization or putting those tubes back together? And most of the time, the patient will realize that IVF is a better option for them when they know they have to have what used to be an open procedure for a tubal reversal. The robot might bring those back to having a chance to conceive naturally.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I just, you know, in our experience at least, the problem with tubal reversals, and oh my God, they're the funnest operation we do, right?
Yes,
I mean, it's just, it's a lot of fun. And I know that probably sounds weird to our listeners for a bunch of surgeons saying, oh, it's a fun operation. But, you know, from our perspective, that's kind of important every now and then. And so it's a great operation to do, but I would tell my patients you're looking at two operations, right? Because, you know, you've had children, you had your tubes tied. Now you're going to come in to get your tubal ligation reversed.
Right.
Let's assume for argument's sake that you're in that 80% that it works for. All right. So then what are you going to do after that? You know, you're going to do something for contraception again. You're going to either go back on the birth control pill or you're going to get your tubes tied again.
Yes.
So it's a second operation potentially.
And we're sure doing a lot less
than
we were when in vitro fertilization had lower success rates.
Sure.
But with y'all just sending us people back so routinely with IVF pregnancies on the first try.
Well, IVF works so well now. It really does. It's amazing. It's amazing. Well, anything else you want to add? Because I know we're going to try and wrap up a little bit early. This is our last show. We're taking a hiatus for the spring. I'm sure that a couple of our listeners will probably be upset by that, but probably the rest of them will think, oh, good, I can do something else with my Saturdays now. But I do want to direct people to our website, www.txfertility.com. We have podcasts up for all of the shows that we've done. There's also a ton of really good, really helpful information on the website. And we also have information about all the seminars that we're doing. So the second Wednesday of every month, we do our IVF seminar at North Austin Medical Center. And on Tuesdays, we also do our Maybe Baby seminar up at Round Rock. And so I encourage people to visit the website. Again, www.txfertility.com. If you have any questions, please call us at 512-451-0149. I'd like to thank all of the guests who we've had on the show who have just been tremendous. I mean, to top things off today with Dr. Chris Seeker, who is really one of Austin's foremost OBGYNs, it's really been a pleasure to have you. I'm so glad that you took the time out of your busy day and your family life to come in and join us today. Thank you so much for being here.
What a pleasure to be here with you, Kalen. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And Snoop's got a special treat, I think, for everybody now coming up. And so thanks so much again for joining us. And please follow us Facebook, Twitter, txfertility.com.
Let's talk just a little bit about sperm cancer. Snoop, you want to talk?
I was free to jump in here.
I just wanted to, no pun intended.
So, actually, my girlfriend just started, so we're good.
Are we on the air with that one? She was going to not like you too much.
We've known each other for 15 minutes already, and now we're...
There's a lot of different things that can affect a man's ability to produce sperm. Smoking, environmental toxins.
If a guy decides to stop smoking today, well, that's terrific. You know, and certainly everybody should stop smoking immediately or as soon as they can and have the willpower to make that decision. But the lingering effects are still going to be present for months.
I had a couple really want to push. He really likes the hot tub, to say, well, you know, his sperm count's really low, so if he can leave the testicles outside the hot tub and get in the hot tub, then it's okay.
You know, I really don't even want to think about that.
Don't try that one at home.
Right.
If you look at the graph of conception by age, it starts dropping around 31 to 32. And some are not even wanting to start until 35 or 40, and for good reasons. They want to get an education, find the right guy. But remember, there's a price to be paid for delaying things.
Trying to say, well, gosh, this is not the worst thing that could happen. There could be like even worse catastrophes in your life, and this is not that bad. And people
For sure. Oh, my gosh. But, you know, everybody says that.
Right.
And it just doesn't make the couple feel better, because what they're struggling with is a huge deal to them. And, you know, they feel, and I think they're right, that no one really knows what it's like unless you've walked in their shoes.
Probably most importantly, I really want to send out some best wishes to one of my partners, Dr. Natalie Berger, who is having a baby today. So you may have been hearing Dr. Berger the last few weeks on the show. You can hear her, and you don't know that she sounds, that she's really, her voice belies what's going on with her, because she has unfortunately been miserable. And she sounds so terrific and so perky and so sweet and so cute. And so we're so excited for Natalie, because we're welcoming another baby into the Texas Fertility Center family today.
I came home on that Friday and I told my husband, we have to get pregnant right now. I have an 18-year-old daughter from, well, probably not that night. I don't, maybe. Anyway.
Maybe.
Yeah, I digress.
We don't want to know what night.
I have a caller on the line, Katie.
Yes, my husband and I have been trying to get pregnant for about 3 years now.
Adoption is ridiculously expensive.
Yes, it is.
But there are many, many, many options.
The frustrating part about it is that we've done every single test you can think of on both of us to see if there is any issues, and nothing has been discovered. You know, the younger you are, the less issues that you're going to have with endometriosis.
So common that we hear this, and endometriosis can decrease your chances of getting pregnant.
Yeah, because it's very frustrating to not have an answer. Some people feel like they could deal with the consequences better if they just knew why.
We're not asking the patient, do you like your periods? We're just trying to figure out what are they like? In other words, are they regular? There's a big difference between every 25 days and every 35 days.